We did make a commitment.
You betrayed me.
You betrayed yourself and Brian.
Look, I don't want anything to do with Rage or you.
Still Queer as Folk.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast, where each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 15 years later. Hi, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
We'll be with you for the next hour or so. So if you enjoy our show, please hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to us so you don't miss an episode. 5-star ratings are also appreciated.
You can also find us across the social platforms at Still Queer AF, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This episode is called House Full of Children. It's number 2 of season 3.
It first aired in the U.S. on March 9th, 2003.
It was directed by one of our favorites, Bruce McDonald. His episodes are very stylish, usually having gritty exteriors, and he quite often makes a cameo in the episodes. Notably, he was the porn director way back in episode 6 of season 2 when Zach O'Toole banged the wide receivers on the football club. McDonald always finds great new angles in the same old sets, which makes the show look fresh and interesting, so he's one of my favorites.
The story for House Full of Children was by Cohen and Lippman, the executive producers of the show. Michael McLennan wrote the teleplay. This is his 6th of 14 episodes.
Here's a recap of House Full of Children from Queer as Folk, the book.
Melanie considers a second child, but Lindsay considers it out of the question.
Brian is fucking young blondes with visions of Justin in his head and starts monopolizing Michael's time. It's like, what is it, sugar plums? Sugar fairies dancing in your head around Christmas time?
Fairies just in general, yes.
Brian is fucking young blondes.
I want to be like, that means it's his life. I don't understand.
What is this book rated?
Justin considers dropping out of school due to cash flow problems until Brian insists on honoring their original financial agreement.
Justin goes back to working with Michael on Rage to pay Brian back.
Emmett has a quickie with a pre-TED arrangement named Dijon.
Like the mustard. I like that little meaningless runner in the episode. By your silence, I can tell that you did not like it, Matt.
Yes, I was not a fan of this episode.
Even Dijon? I thought Dijon was great.
It wasn't just Dijon. Actually, Dijon wasn't the problem with this episode. I just found everybody kind of insufferable. We'll get to them.
Wow.
When we get to our hits and misses, we can talk more.
So the A story here, Brian, Justin, and Ethan, no surprise there. This was a great Bruce McDonald trademark intro. I love the way that he finds all these new angles and these new places to look at the scenery. We actually start outside of Brian's loft, swoop through the window, across the sitting area, all the way over to the dining table where Brian is banging what looks like Justin. But it's not. There's a hot trick covered in cum. Nice touch. Good prop work. Is that prop work or is that a costume?
That's like a hair and makeup thing.
Shop buckets. Mind if I use your shower?
Wear it home proudly. I'm busy.
You're just kicking me out?
You got it.
I was amazed because the trick says I shot buckets. And like, he wasn't kidding.
Yeah.
Like, he was covered. I was like, I thought you were just covered in royal icing.
That's my favorite though. Not the icing, just
covering someone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you know.
But
no
unlike,
arguments here either.
Unlike Brian, I do let them hose off in my shower before they go home.
Am I to assume that Brian fucked this trick so hard that he came without touching himself? Is this the implication?
I don't know if somebody would blow that big of a load without touching themselves.
I don't want to give Brian that much credit.
I do. He was going at it with that little Twinkie boy.
Sure, but to say I shot buckets?
He did. We saw it.
Yes, I understand, but it's just...
That's the amount of load that you can just scoop up and like use for other purposes when you're all done.
This podcast is going in a very different direction right now.
We do carry an explicit rating for a reason. So that scene really sets the stage for us to see that Brian isn't quite done with Justin yet. He misses him. He envisions fucking him, or as the intro said, Brian is fucking young blondes with visions of Justin in his head.
Yes. And
they weren't kidding.
And when the trick asks if he can hose off in the shower, which I felt was just a polite thing to offer.
You at least need a cum rag.
Something.
Yeah. He just sent this guy out. He didn't give him a napkin
at,
or anything.
At first, he said, no, don't do it. Wear it as a badge of honor. And I was like, that's kind of hot. I'm kind of there for it. And then the trick realizes, like, oh, he's seriously kicking him out. And he says that, why are the best fucks always the biggest jerks? Now, what I found interesting about this opening scene and as the episode progresses, that I think we're seeing Brian losing himself in sex. And it makes me wonder if he actually enjoys sex.
At this time or previously?
Well, it makes me question a lot of his behavior throughout the series, that everything is all about the hunt and just finding the hottest guy. And I don't see him actually taking a moment to really revel in the pleasure. It all just seems like there's a yet unattainable goal. It's almost like an addiction.
I think in this particular episode, though, it was designed to show that he misses the affection that he could show to Justin. I agree with you about all the other tricking that he did, where it was just about getting off. He could care less about the person. He just wanted to blow his load. And that's why a lot of them are quickies. Like the first episode, where we see him in the toilet with the client that he's trying to sell something to, and he seduces him with an apple.
Well, again, that was just an end goal of trying to win the client over. That was less about Brian's sexual pleasure, and that was more about closing the deal.
Well, I don't know about that. I think that was really about Brian getting off, and he was opportunistic about it.
How about 70-30? That's what I think of. I think 30% was for Brian to get off. 70% was to make the sale.
There's a great scene at the diner, and there's some really nice awkwardness between Brian, Michael, and Justin. They're all circling around, but that seemed like pretty quick after Brian had belted Michael. Because remember, like, the entire gang just erupted. Ben was like about to kill him, and Debbie's like, you're an animal. And Melanie, of course, is like, leave now. You know, she got all like sass filled.
Right. They're beating him up on the airplane.
Yeah. So it seemed a little unusual that anger had kind of disappeared so quickly, right? Everyone got over it really quickly.
Although we did see in the previous episode that at least Michael and Brian had worked it out.
Well, I brought him a steak.
Debbie can still have some animosity towards him, clearly. And also, of all the people in this group, Justin is the one who still has a job, so if Michael is going to be wanting to stop by the diner, he could at least ask Debbie, when is Justin not working? Or yeah, something like that, where he doesn't have to cross paths with him.
Well, that's something interesting about this diner scene was Michael just kept throwing barbs at Justin.
It's like, you can leave. You're the one harassing the employee right now.
Well, he didn't harass him. He went up and he wanted to work with him again. He slipped in this strange line that I don't know why it was there.
Still here, I see.
I tried to quit. Your mother wouldn't let me.
Yeah, well, we all know how subtle her powers of persuasion can be.
Besides, I need the money.
I guess Brian came in handy for something.
That was enough for Justin to go, uh-huh, same old Michael. This storyline of jealousy, though, just needs to end.
And what helps what you're talking about is that there's that other line that Michael has where it says, you betrayed yourself and Brian.
We did make a commitment.
You betrayed me.
You betrayed yourself and Brian.
Look, I don't want anything to do with Rage or you.
Brian doesn't need you to speak for him.
Yeah, definitely not.
That's why he decked you in the first place.
In-universe time has been, what, like a year and a half since Justin and Brian met? So why is Michael still harping on this? Hasn't he gotten over it or at least gotten accustomed to it?
Clearly because he's harbored feelings for Brian for years.
But I mean, come on, a year and a half, you got to be able to get over that, especially like seeing somebody every day and waiting at the hospital when he was like turned into a vegetable.
Yes,
it's like, come
on. I'm at that point where I am just not buying this whole, well, he's my best friend. He's also an adult. You have got to back the fuck off and live your own life.
It's great that Justin just shut his ass down, though. I really like it when Justin is very grown up.
Oh, I'm a big fan of that. Because again, he was from the beginning of this series, Justin has always been able to take those barbs that Michael sends his way and just, you know, smacks them away. Like, oh, you tried to come for me, I'm going to come for you.
Daphne showed up in this episode.
Oh, hey, Daphne.
Why was she offhand to Ethan, though? Did you notice that?
I had the same question. I was not aware that Daphne, I guess, doesn't like Ethan. She was very cold shoulder to him.
Yeah. When he came over and sat down, she was just like, I don't know why, though. Yeah, what team was she on?
Like, he even says, like, hey, Daph. And she sort of gives him a shrug. Like, ooh.
Justin used a term here that I thought was interesting.
Last night we made love on the roof, underneath the stars. Never did anything like that with Brian.
How long have these two been together?
This is like a few weeks?
Yeah, this is the same kind of accelerated story that we've seen before. They had no trouble getting to the love state.
And the same thing happens with Ted and Emmett, which we'll get to. It seems that feelings that happen between these characters happen at such an accelerated rate, questions the believability of the episode and of the storyline.
Somebody else showed up, Jennifer Taylor.
Oh, hey, Jennifer!
Hello, Sherry Miller. We last saw her at Babylon, I think, right?
Yes, for the Rage release party. Yeah.
She had some interesting lines there where she says that Ethan is more appropriate than Brian.
Oh, well... Seems like an accomplished young man.
Don't leave out cute.
Very cute. Certainly more appropriate for you than Brian. Not that I have anything against Brian. If it hadn't been for him, I don't know what either one of us would have
done. Do you mind if we don't talk about him? I'm with Ethan now.
She was in love with Ethan. Yeah. Ethan is that boy that you take home to mom.
She had an interesting interaction with Justin here. I like how Justin is all in on Ethan. I talked about this in the last episode. I just love that decisiveness. I just love that he's there, he's present, he's in the moment, and he's saying, Mom, I'm with Ethan. I don't care about Brian. It's great.
Yeah, it's a great way for Justin to really lay down the boundaries. And I love that Jennifer Taylor is very accepting of that and saying, like, oh, you know what? You're right. You are with Ethan. I'm going to cut off the pass. It's probably a personal win for her as well. Now her teenage son, or wait, no, is he still a teenager?
He is.
He's still a teenager. Her teenage son is not with the man that technically had an illegal relationship with him.
He actually didn't. Remember, we looked this up. The age of consent in Pennsylvania was 16.
Oh, let's say an unethical relationship.
Well,
to Jennifer's eyes, it was not, as she said, appropriate.
Yeah, Jennifer and Craig Taylor, who we talk about in a little bit, but yeah. I don't want to shame older men that date younger men.
Oh, not at all.
Okay.
I love me a daddy.
Thank you. Zaddy.
Yes. Can we talk about what Jennifer was wearing at that lunch meet?
Oh, I didn't notice.
How could you not? I was like, you are a modern woman.
What'd she have on? Like a Hillary Clinton pantsuit?
Well, okay. So it was this beige turtleneck that she was totally rocking. I loved the bob. It was slightly Rachel from Friends. Awesome, like, leather jacket that was tailored for the gods. I was here for her entire look. I was like, you are a modern, professional, single woman living her best life. Go Jennifer Taylor.
Yeah, I was going to say she's single now, so... she's out and about. I think it's interesting that Michael has all these opportunities to get close to Brian now, which is something that he's always wanted, but he's not really embracing it willingly now. You would think that he would just go all in, kind of the way that he did with Dr. David Cameron. We talked about that last episode. Mm-hmm. But still, he's just kind of pulling away from Brian at every chance. But he's wanted this guy for like ever, and he wanted to be close to him. Everything that he's telling Justin is, I yearn for the good old days of just me and Brian. But he just doesn't go for it here. And I thought that was curious because he did before. He did last season. It didn't really cost him Dr. David that we saw. Remember, Dr. David just kind of disappeared one day.
Yes. And here we have like wonderful moment where they're Michael and Ben are trying to have the quiet night at home. They've made dinner and Emmett's not going to be home because he's going to be with Ted. And it's going to be great. It's just going to be the two of them. And then who comes knocking on the door? Brian.
Yeah. In the Michael that we've come to expect would be welcoming of that.
He was still one hell of an enabler in this episode. But here, I think you're right in that he does start to show a little bit more of resistance. Whereas in the last episode, even Ben was like, you got to go. You got to go and make sure he's okay because he just lost, you know, he lost the person he loves. So go and take care of him. But here, even Ben's like, we were really going to stay home. Can you please respect that? And it's that and this was my thing with Brian in this entire episode is that I felt he was such a weak character. No, I mean, maybe that's to help sell this lost love. He doesn't know what to do with himself. It was almost grating having to go on this journey with Michael of trying to find himself again post-Justin. Because now he's trying to convince him to go to Babylon again because it's Nine Inch Night.
Oh, I would go.
Would you have to pay for a ticket or would you get in for free?
I'd get in for free.
I hope all of our listeners just took that in.
And you've seen it before.
That is very true. And I love his little, I do like Brian's dig of, I was hoping I could buy your tickets. And I was like, Brian, we have seen drawings of your dick and I don't think you're 9 inches either.
That's true.
So calm your ass down.
Retroactive continuity. I just thought this whole Brian, Michael, Ben thing was just a light beer version of the story that we saw in season one with Dr. David Cameron and Michael. I just wish they could have done something more with it.
Because there's not as much conflict, or as direct conflict, I should say.
Ben was too accommodating for it to begin with, and Michael put up the most basic of fights against it. But
I almost described it as, stop, don't,
stop, please, wait, don't, come back.
Yes. For all those who have ever seen Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, that's what it's like.
Stop, don't, come back.
No, stop, please, come
back. Something else that was weird about this was this dinner at Debbie's when Michael doesn't show up and nobody is actually worried about it. They're just pissed off at him.
How dare he skip out on dinner at Debbie's?
Yeah, I mean,
that asshole.
If you had a dinner scheduled with your mother, your Uncle Vic, Ben, and you didn't show up, don't you think people would be like, is he okay? Is he dead in a ditch?
And they like,
but they go right to anger.
And they try to justify it by Ben acknowledging that it was probably something that Brian did.
Yeah.
Because he lost the person he loves. So he is using his best friend to try and help him. And I like that Debbie points out that you're so kind and compassionate. Fuck that.
Yeah, that was a nice tight scene with Debbie, Vic, and Ben. I really like that.
That scene was the palate cleanser for me for this episode.
But an incredibly kind, compassionate thing to say. You really are a hell of a nice guy.
Thank you, Debbie.
Fuck nice. Unless you knock some sense into that boyfriend of yours, Brian's going to keep hauling him off to God knows where, and he should be here with you.
It's not up to me. I can't control him.
Why not? She's been doing it for 30 years.
Let's just hope Michael wakes up and realizes he's just a substitute for Justin.
Only trouble is, the substitute's usually the last to know.
Sauce.
Justin goes and sees his dad again. We haven't seen Craig Taylor since season one,
I think. Oh, hey.
Yeah.
Craig.
So Craig apparently wears his leather jacket indoors and around the house.
He might as well be wearing sunglasses.
Yeah. So he's having a drink and it's like, we know Craig Taylor to be an alcoholic.
Yes, but he's pouring his son a scotch.
Yeah, his 18-year-old son. I think it was whiskey, wasn't it? Was it scotch? It's probably scotch.
So, yeah.
And why didn't it occur to Justin that he should really be talking to Craig without the booze? Like, maybe meet him, like, at lunch. I guess you were a boozer, though. You're boozing at lunch, too. But why does Justin go, like, let me go after work when dad's going to be, like, at his most lubricated, right?
Yeah.
It's like, that's not the time. That's your timing's off.
Justin is on a deadline, so he probably had to see him as soon as he could.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good story between Craig and Justin, but I wish the writers would have done more with
something.
It. It's the same thing that we come back to all the time is these stories are so lightweight in a lot of ways. And what people really latch onto is a much broader arc of the characters. So when we're digging this apart one episode at a time, we see all these flaws, but then a lot of people on social media are like, how dare you think that? We're like, well, you know, it's within the context of this episode, right?
The context of this episode and the point of why we're going back is to view it with today's lens. Things have changed in the past 17 years. So that's why we may seem a little more critical in that we now are demanding more. And I think that that's okay. Because again, there have been episodes that have totally still landed, mm-hmm. which is really impressive. That's hard to do with a series that was so of its time. And so, yeah, that, we still do this. We wouldn't be doing this if we didn't actually love the series.
So this scene was just a couple minutes for Craig to say no to Justin.
Justin, I told you when you were applying to colleges.
I know what you told me. But now that I've completed my first year with honors, in spite of the hand, I thought maybe you would change your mind. Look, I can't get a scholarship because you make too much money. And I can't go to school and work full time.
What about Brian?
We're not together anymore.
Finally, some good news. I'm glad to see you've come to your senses. Now, if you want to talk about going to Dartmouth or...
Dad, I'm never going to be a businessman. And I'm never going to be straight.
Yes, it was not nearly as explosive the last time we saw Craig.
Yeah. But, oh, that's my favorite line from Craig, where Justin says, he wore a condom, I put it on myself.
He wore a condom? I put it on myself.
Oh, God! I'm calling the police.
Put it on myself.
It's like, ow!
But because, again, Justin is making it very clear that he's proud of who he is. He will always be who he is. And Craig just has to either deal with that or... step off. Mm-hmm. And it was, and at least in what we've seen in this interaction between the two of them, we are believing that Craig has not learned anything. And it, like, I'm assuming this is the first time he has seen his son since that time.
Well, I like the character. In season one, he was just a really powerful anti-character. He was like suburban dad that a lot of gay teenagers coming out face. So I thought that character was really well written in season one, kind of comes back in season three, and it's very tidy wrap up again. Dad, can I have some money for college? No. Cut, print.
And that's a wrap on Craig.
Yeah. A series wrap on Craig. Yay. So I like that underwear party event that Brian and Michael went to.
I was trying to understand Michael's reaction to the party.
Well, first let's describe this party.
Yes.
So everyone is in white undies. Except Brian, who has black trunks on. Put that man in briefs, for God's sakes. There's a great song playing. There's purple-ish lighting. And it's just this
sort of neon-y look. Yeah.
It's a super sexually charged environment. And this reminded me of something, too, that there's a bar in Chicago called Scarlet that used to have something very, very similar. And this was not a long time ago. This was maybe... within the last 4 years, it was a pants-off party.
Oh.
So it wasn't like a sex party, but you'd go in, you'd check your pants, and you essentially are just having a normal night out at the bar in your underwear. It was great. I loved it.
Just make sure you have cute underwear on. I see no problem with that. I do that.
Yeah, you dress to impress.
Clearly.
I remember going to it once, and I had boots on. I don't remember. They weren't like combat boots, but they were... I don't know, probably like John Bravado's boots or something like that. And I looked almost like, I don't know, I was wearing like a black tank top. I had black briefs on and boots. I don't know what scene that put me in, but through the night, I started to realize that I was being put into a very different scene than I really am in.
Yeah. I just imagine it being like the goth kids from South Park.
Well, and so after that, I just started to wear Vans instead of boots, and that was much more comfortable.
There you go.
So anyway, Michael's reaction to this scene, I couldn't tell. I saw
that. It was so blank.
Yeah. Like, was he going to join in? Was he like happy to be there?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I don't think he was, at least at first, happy to be there because he was demanding his phone. He was trying to get a hold of Ben to come and get him. And then we have this whole... I want to say seduction that is going on, where Brian is dancing with this guy that he has described to Michael exactly what he's going to do to him.
First, I'm going to wear out his jaw and my cock. Then, I'm going to reach around, back, and start fingering. Why not see for yourself?
Mm-hmm. And he goes over to the guy and starts to do said things to him.
Get it.
And Michael sort of flinches or something. And they keep cutting back and forth to Michael, to Brian, and his hand going all over this guy. And then eventually his hand's going down the guy's underwear. Oh. But again, Michael's not having...
That guy was hot too, by the way.
Well, correct. Yes, they were all very hot. And Michael doesn't do anything. And then they cut away from the scene.
Yeah, I wonder if, here's the hypothesis, if we're led to believe that it cut away because Michael dove into the party and Michael got some that night. I like thinking that. I like thinking that there's more to the scene than was actually shown to us. And that sounds very typically Bruce McDonald.
Because all we get from the next day is Ben using...
Didn't Michael get home at like 4 a.m.?
2:45-ish.
Okay.
Is what Ben said. And yeah, so he looks really tired.
Yeah,
he totally... It didn't seem particularly like hungover. I think he just seemed exhausted.
I think that was like Hal Sparks doing his best like hangover. I think Michael totally got laid that night.
I think that's interesting, but I just feel dramaturgically that doesn't really land, because then that would have had to have been something that gets talked about with the way they're talking, with the way this show sets up Michael and Ben.
Well, it's kind of this lingering pall over the episode, no?
Well, especially, well, no, because that's something they explored with Dr. David Cameron already.
That's true. Well, this is a rehash and a retelling of the... Dr. David's story. So yeah, it's a curious scene.
Only this time Michael is the one in the bathhouse.
Yeah.
So does that mean Ben's going to have some random hookup in a cemetery?
I mean, let's think about it. What do you think Michael was doing there until 2:45 in the morning? Because he went there around supper time at Debbie's house. So that was like 8 or 9 o'clock. And he stayed out until 2:45. What was he doing all night?
Well, we know
there?
His phone dies at the party.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian is his ride home.
He totally got some at that party.
Okay.
Listeners, let us know. At this party,
do you think Michael got laid, or if he just stood there like a wallflower?
He's probably a wallflower now that I think about it. Let's talk about Justin's tuition here. Justin comes over to the loft, and Brian is watching something on TV, which I figured out is a movie from 1961 called One-Eyed Jacks with Marlon Brando.
Is that what it was? I was trying to figure out what it was. I thought I was going to recognize it right away.
Yeah, so weirdly, Brian knows all the words. So check out the synopsis of this movie, though. After robbing a Mexican bank, Dad Longworth takes the loot and leaves his partner Rio to be captured. But Rio escapes and searches for Dad in California. I think there's some symbolism there.
That's pretty on the nose, because that's such a specific movie for Brian to know all the words to.
What do you think of Brian still paying Justin's tuition?
For all of his faults, Brian is still a man of his word.
Mm.
From a business perspective, he has an agreement, he's going to stick to it. And I think that's interesting. That gives him like at least one redeeming quality.
Well, it also gives him one opportunity to stay in contact with Justin.
Oh, that's a little more menacing.
Yeah.
I was trying to give him a little more benefit of the doubt.
Because I don't know. If
now I like him less.
If I was Brian in this case and I was paying for somebody's tuition, then they were suddenly not seeing me and seeing somebody else and not talking to me anymore. Why am I paying your tuition? Right? It's like you have to be present in somebody's life for that, unless he prepaid it.
But then,
and then it's like, Justin, take the computer with you too.
But the thing, Justin then kind of flips and saying that I'm going to pay you back, which then forces his hand to reunite with Michael in continuing rage.
Yeah, but he said that as soon as he agreed to take the money from Brian in the first place, because remember they wrote up an agreement.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There was going to be interest, and then Justin topped him.
Yes.
So
to seal the deal.
That agreement was already there. I'm just not too certain that anybody should continue to pay those bills other than to keep the person close. To keep that person kind of under your thumb.
Because it's a very convoluted way to say that it's Brian's way of trying to get Justin to pursue what he loves, which is creating the Rage comic.
I don't think that's what Justin loves, though. He loves
to do the illustration. He loves to draw. He loves to create the art.
And Brian's all, I don't know, kind of, you have important work to do. Rage. It's like, ugh, really? What's so important about that? And then Justin and Michael just make up. Boom. Brian wants us to make up. We made up. I just hated that. It was so just it too done. Easy.
So it is done. So shall it be written that they are friends? They are, well, creative partners again, I will say.
Yeah. It takes more time to get okay with things there. You can't just like all of a sudden be like okay with it and off you go.
Yeah, everything just about this just tried to wrap it up in a somewhat neat manner, and I just didn't buy it.
There's a nice exit scene of Brian on the dance floor of Babylon. Bruce McDonald didn't disappoint me at all in this episode. I just wish he would have directed the entire series. It would have just looked so much better. It would have been much more stylish. It would have been a little more edgy. Those exteriors that he always does are great. The NYPD blue exteriors that I talked about.
Still queer as folk.
Still queer as folk. There's more on the way. If you like our show, please give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Good morning, lover.
Lover.
I hate that word.
What, lover?
Yes, and I just hated this whole, like, Ted and Emmett thing in this episode.
This whole thing of Ted and Emmett as lovers is so... At first, okay, I will say this. At first, I thought it was kind of cute.
Yeah, but it just accelerated so quickly.
This whole series does this with couples. As soon as they put their dicks in one another,
yeah, coupled. You bet.
Like, they're describing themselves as boyfriends. They're already in love with each other. Should you put in any kind of work to this?
I actually felt a little creeped out as Ted was doing that lover talk with Emmett in bed.
Lover.
I was just like, ooh.
And they said it would never work.
Fools, what did they know?
Ooh, more cream, sweetheart?
Thanks, lover.
Lover. How I love that word.
I don't know what it was. It's Emmett's like all cuddled up under the duvet. And here comes Ted with a special coffee. And it's like, oh, God, I don't know.
For his lover.
Ted just was creepy there. I didn't feel... this sense of connectedness between them. I was just thinking,
this and like that complimentary talk they were giving each other in terms of how each lover was in bed the night before. I was just like, what? No one talks like this.
At the diner later with Brian, I love Brian's reaction shots. Ted is feeding Emmett something. He's like, here comes a choo-choo, choo-choo, choo-choo.
This was a joke, right? They saw that it was bothering Brian, so they like egged it on, right?
I don't think so. They seem sincere about it.
God, then I understand Brian going like, what the fuck?
Ted calls it a loving, mature relationship. This thing is just like took off. It's like all of a sudden it's a loving mature relationship.
No.
Yeah.
No.
He just
creeped me out. They were annoying. And showboating this quote-unquote relationship in front of a guy who just lost his. So they're kind of being dicks, too.
Who never really believed in relationships to begin with. And he also thinks that Ted and Emmett together is just kind of like, ooh.
It was just so crazily unbelievable for them to act so in love the way they did.
Yeah.
That I legitimately thought, I was like, you are all just, you're amping it up because it's gonna be funny to piss Brian off, right? Right? Please tell me that's what you're doing, because otherwise I want to turn this episode off, because I hate that.
There's a nice little story arc here that I actually liked, and that's Dijon,
like the mustard.
I love this character. He was on a 3-day laid over. He's a flight attendant. And here's something that I thought... really stretched reality here, where Emmett calls the gay crisis hotline over his arrangement with Dijon.
I know I may not be standing here with a razor blade at my wrist or a light bulb up my ass, but I need to talk to someone now. I've been waiting for the goddamn gay crisis helpline to take my call for the past 15 minutes.
You should tell them you have a really bad temp job. I'm sure they'd put you right through.
That was a bad comedy moment. You don't call the gay crisis hotline over... Well, I said that I would blow Dijon when he is back in town on his 3-day layover, but oh my God, what do I do? Let me call the gay crisis hotline. Fuck.
And I think this touches on my main issue with this episode. The tone. The tone of the episode is so unbalanced that I couldn't tell if it was grounded in a very clear reality or it was just going for pure sitcom in these moments.
Yeah, it was definitely sitcom-y the whole episode. I think you really hit on something there where we lost the drama. And it just goes straight to farcical screwball comedy.
I don't know what I need to be feeling. Because I think series and film can do that, can play around with genre and do the extremes, but you got to be smart about it. And this episode was just not.
I did like that Dijon has his own rolling drink cart. That was funny.
I the fact that he rolled it up to Emmett.
Oh, yeah. Put his tray table down and everything.
In the upright position.
Dijon works for Liberty Air. Liberty Air comes back again. And he had that trophy prop for servicing over 10,000 passengers.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Let's talk about Dijon's apartment. So I guess...
Oh, I loved it.
I guess his hub is Pittsburgh.
His hub.
It must be if he has a whole home here, or I would assume.
Yeah, that looked like a very nice crash pad in the city as you're circulating through, I don't know, the Midwest on Liberty Air. Yeah, I liked his apartment. And as he serves Emmett, it's complete with that little seatbelt bong sound that you get on the plane.
I will say, at least they were committed to the bit with Dijon.
Emmett was upright and in the locked position.
To service.
I love this scene. It was goofy and silly, but I think Peter Page acted it well. He just brought this nice little serious comedy moment to the show. I liked it.
So the grandfather clause, which Brian brings up, I have never seen that in the gay manual. I don't know if
there's... Oh, I have. That's real.
That's a real thing.
Absolutely.
I hate gay men.
Well, you are the type that want to rule out the grandfather clause and be selfish and keep this man all to yourself, irregardless of previous relationships and commitments.
Listeners, I am rolling my eyes so hard right now. I am happy to acknowledge that if I start dating someone and then we become... Well, here's the thing, though. I wouldn't become exclusive with someone after 2 weeks. That's the difference. So sure, whatever. It's 2 weeks. But here, these characters are claiming they're in love with each other and like they might as well be moving in together. It was just insane. And then for this grandfather clause to cause such doubt in Emmett about whether or not he should suck this guy off.
The gay crisis hotline had to
didn't
call him.
Answer. To know what would have happened if the gay crisis hotline had picked up. Would we have been in this predicament to begin with?
There probably would have been a more interesting episode.
Right. What if they had picked up after, or maybe Emmett talked to the gay crisis hotline and got their advice, which is they're saying you can't do anything or you shouldn't if you have real feelings. And then Brian pulls out the grandfather clause. And then Emmett's real conflicted and then gives into temptation.
So let's go to the gym then and say hello to Dijon, who just happens to be working out at the social gym at the same time.
And might as well have just shoved Ted out of the way.
Oh, yeah. He just stepped right in between.
He just slid right in.
I like the casting difference here because Dijon is like muscular 6'3", and Ted's probably like 5'9", kind of like doughy. And
he's just
here
kind
comes,
of there.
Yeah, Dijon is just like present right
oh,
there.
Oh, yeah.
Loved it. So were Emmett and Ted actually completely exclusive already?
That's what it made it sound like. It sounded like as soon as they said they were in love with each other that night at Babylon, that they are together and no man shall pass between them. And then enter Dijon.
That seemed a little unclear to me, almost as if we had to believe like, oh, they said, okay, let's give it a shot at Babylon. Then they tried to fuck and it couldn't happen. Then they tried again and it happened. Then it's like, hello, lover. Okay, I guess we're a couple. They need to have that conversation though, right? It's like
yes,
a non-emotional
what does this mean
conversation
between us.
Right.
We had a wonderful night of passion, lover. And but apparently that meant exclusive. What?
So Emmett shows up at the porn basement, which makes a return. And Ted just turns into a total Jekyll and Hyde here.
Well, he's heartbroken.
Yes, but he's jumping back and forth between best friend of Emmett and lover. And so Jekyll and Hyde, he's just like, this is a flagrant violation. And
but as best friend.
Yeah, that was just kind of goofy. I don't know. I like the comedy of it, but I don't think it did much for the story.
See, you saw it as a comedy. I saw it as their attempt to try and find some pathos in this episode.
Pathos?
Yes. Like, they wanted to have some sort of emotional connection happen where he didn't know if Ted was going to accept his apology, if he was ever going to be forgiven. He didn't know where he stood with Ted as a lover or even as a best friend.
Well, Ted made it pretty clear, though. But then Emmett's I wish I could talk to my friend, my best friend, Ted. And that's where Ted just went like back and forth is, I don't know, it was.
He's just like, I'm angry. And yet I understand.
Yeah.
Yet I can't forgive you, but I can.
He says that Emmett's been single all these years and that it's hard for him to settle down.
What about George?
Exactly. That wasn't that long ago.
What?
$10 million around the world.
Do we all
trip?
Forget about that, apparently?
Pickles. Come on. Where is this continuity here? It's like, ugh.
Again, the show can be like the Golden Girls where they just say, fuck it all. It's a continuity. They don't care. You're going to watch it anyway. But of course, it seems that Ted, the best friend, wins out and finds it in his heart to forgive Emmett so they can continue to be lovers.
Oh, cue like the somber music there. Or the emotional oboe.
Still queer as folk.
Melanie and Lindsay. Look, Melanie is law.
They're not appealing. It's settled. Yeah, we need to draft up a payment schedule. The notes are on my hard drive.
Now we find out that she's also a litigator. She's talking about an actual trial that was in play as she's making her way up into the lesbian playground is what I called it. It's all lesbians running around with their children.
Yes, like it's almost like a power play happening here. Like, who's the dyke mom of them all?
Kind lesbians of that brush together have babies together.
That's very true.
And then they jump into the tub to smoke weed and drink wine.
Hey, if that's where mature modern gay relationships go, I'm into it.
Oh, I love that scene. It was just unusual to see the lesbians smoking weed and drinking wine in the tub. I love that. I like tub play. Tub play's fun. I don't smoke weed, but I'll drink wine in the tub.
I'm a big fan, yeah. And they were like, they were sort of playing with each other.
Yeah.
But like having a serious conversation about having another child at the same time.
The scene was so well lit, had kind of this orange hue to it. It was nice.
I think this is the best treatment that the lesbians have gotten in this series.
Yeah, totally. It was very tasteful. I liked it.
Yes, it was wonderful. It wasn't. Yeah, it definitely didn't feel as explicit as some of the other sexual scenes that they've had.
At the playground, this character, Dusty, is carrying around what looks like a fake baby in a sling. You could not see the actual baby. And I'm like, what is that? She had, I think you called it a Bjorn. Or something?
Yes. Or at least in this, I mean, here it's a more holistic, like, rap thing. You just...
Yeah, I didn't know what it was. It's like...
What? Yeah, you just...
There's a baby in there.
Yeah, you hold the baby because it's wrapped up in a certain way that is secure.
It's like Queer as Folk continues its fake baby heritage.
Yes.
There's a new plot element that we're introduced here with the lesbians, which is Melanie can't have children. Boom! Out of nowhere. Never heard that before, ever.
Right, and as they're having this conversation about having a second child, but didn't Melanie like begin this episode with saying like they just like paid off something? Like I thought like with like the litigation that helps them financially. Great, let's have another kid. Wait, what?
Yeah, oh, I can't have kids. Boom, what? How'd that happen?
Yes, and Lindsay uses it as ammo against Melanie, which I thought, that's kind of bitchy.
It's a wonderful scene between Melanie and Debbie.
So you'd rather leave the dirty work to her?
No, that's not it.
Well, what is it then?
It's that she's braver and stronger and a better woman than I'll ever be.
That's the biggest load of horseshit I've ever heard.
So I guess this is breakfast at the diner, but why was the place empty? There was not a single client in there.
Right. It must have been like 4 a.m. Maybe it's that like weird lull right before they serve all the partiers from that night.
It's a really nice tight scene though between Michelle Clooney and Sharon Gless. They acted that really well. Yes, there's good dialogue.
Debbie cuts through it and just saying like, what's wrong? Because it's like, that's what Melanie needs to hear. She just has to have someone who could listen to her. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really nice.
So this story really didn't go too far. This was, I think, setting us up for a future episode. We just find out that Melanie can't have children, that the lesbians like to get in the tub and smoke weed. And that's pretty much it.
Yes, it just made me question Lindsay's reaction was so volatile that it made me question that maybe these will get answered as the series as the season continues. Is what insecurities is she harboring about having a second child? Was it because when she was
she can't have one?
Well, no, I'm sorry, with Lindsay.
Oh,
excuse me. What insecurities is Lindsay harboring? Because when she was with child, I mean, technically, it was rough in those beginning year, in the beginning months of having Gus, you know, because Melanie cheats and things like that.
Well, we don't know that, do we?
Well, we know that Melanie cheated.
Not while she was pregnant. Not while Lindsay was pregnant, though.
Well, I'm saying that in the beginning of them having the child.
Oh, in Gus's early years.
Yes, in the early years of Gus. That had happened. So I was like, is that part of it? Like, why is she so adverse to having a second child?
I think a lot of people will have their first child and be like, I'm never going through that again.
Sure.
I believe the point of this little story was that the couple needs to come together to discuss having a new child. Whereas Melanie was like, yeah, we're going to have another baby. And she kind of made that type A determination on her own. She didn't really have the conversation with Lindsay about it. And that's what Lindsay was so upset about.
Like, she ordered for Lindsay at the restaurant.
Exactly. We would like one fake baby to go. Okay, let's tie this episode up and recap it here with our hits and misses. So my first hit, my only hit, was The Trick Covered in Cum. That was a huge hit for me. It was a nicely shot sex scene that started outside of Brian's loft and ended up with a drenched twink. Well done, Bruce McDonald.
If the load didn't look like it was icing from the Great British Bake Off, I would have been more into it. So I respect that. My hit, Jennifer Taylor's ensemble. I was obsessed with that look. I was snaps for her. Snaps for that look. She was selling it. Selling it like she's a real estate agent. Big fan.
My miss in this episode was Justin and Michael making up. Like all things in Queer as Folk, resolution of problems is swift before we can really dig in and live with it for a bit. So I wanted to see that animosity carry along.
Can I say the whole episode? Just about everything and everyone, save for Jennifer Taylor's ensemble, just like grated at me with their insufferable whining and snappy attitudes towards each other. That save for Jennifer Taylor's costume and that wonderful dinner scene between Debbie and Vic and Ben, that I could not stand it. I get that Brian is suffering, but I'm over Michael's storyline that he feels he has to defend Brian. I'm over Brian, using sex as a coping mechanism. I didn't
mind the episode very much. I kind of enjoyed it. But again, I had to suspend disbelief through a lot of it and just kind of roll with it. So I didn't hate it as much as you did.
And again, the tonal shifts just didn't work for me. I'll have to call out season 3, episode 2 as not as terrible as the wedding episode, but not one of my favorites.
This has been episode 2 of season 3, House Full of Children.
Next time, Lindsay and Mel ask Brian about fathering a second child with them.
Debbie is nervous about spending the night with Carl.
Ben decides against moving in with Michael.
That will be episode 3 of season 3, and it's called Doctors of Dickology. Thanks for joining us. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us, and subscribe. It does mean a lot to us and helps more people find our show.
We're on Twitter at StillQueerAF, as well as Instagram. And you can find us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
And if you want to connect with us personally, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD.
We'll see you next time. Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.
Still Queer as Folk.